From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Mary Roach, who has written Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Now, we pre-taped this interview for you a couple days ago, and here it is for you now. Enjoy. Our first guest this morning is Mary Roach, who has written Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Now, what should we do with a jaywalking moose? How about a bear caught breaking and entering? Or a murderous tree? Well, according to science author Mary Roach, 300 years ago, animals that broke the law would be assigned legal representation and put on trial. These days, the answers are best found not in the field of law, but in science. Mary Roach, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much, John. Lovely to be here.
Well, it's really good to have you back because, I think this is your third appearance on Cool Science Radio. We first spoke to you about your book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And then my favorite, the taboo, icky, underappreciated, as you call it, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And I have to tell you, my favorite, I mean, I like the book, I like the entire book, but to have three chapters on flatulence, I just thought that was great.
Well, there was a lot to say, John. You know, we had how do you study it? We had hydrogen sulfide, and then I think we had, there was another angle. Anyway, I broke it down and I covered it all.
We get up in the morning, we shower, we say goodbye to our kids, we go to work. And some people, I guess, were going to work in a flatulence lab to smell flatulence and record their observations. That's quite a job.
That's right. Yeah. It's the people who make Beano have a whole flatulence research unit. And I was a subject.
Yeah. Well, Fuzz... is, you know, when nature breaks the law, maybe we can start with how did this idea come together?
Well, I came upon this odd 1906 book called The Criminal Prosecution and Capital Punishment of Animals, which detailed, as you mentioned, the legal approach to animals misbehaving, which really makes very little sense, as animals, first of all, the laws aren't written for them. They can't read them. You can't find them. although that was done. So it was it's a strange book. It's long, it's well documented. I wrote about a case in which a lot of caterpillars were, this was 1659 in Italy, in a farming community. They posted summons asking the caterpillars to come appear in court where they'd be assigned legal representation. So it was just kind of mind-blowing that was the approach. And I thought, well, okay, the legal system doesn't afford any good solutions, but what about science? What can we do? And what do people do in other countries as well? Different approaches. So that's how I landed there.
And how rude of the caterpillars, after they post it, the statement that they had to show up at a certain time, that they didn't show up at court. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Scofflaws.
Yeah. And then I recall reading in your book, they cordoned off a lot of land that they said, you know, you guys can go there and hang out and, you know, stay out of our vegetable gardens and things like that. But they didn't pay attention to that either, did they?
Well, by that point, they'd pupated and moved on. So things sort of resolved themselves. But in fact, to provide an alternate plot of delicious food is something that is done today. That's called a lure crop, where you plant something cheap, easily maintained, that's appealing, say, for blackbirds or crows or whatever is eating your commercial crop. So you try to lure them to the next field, give them an alternative source of food. So the solution that the town fathers had was actually a good one.
A couple of years ago, I was in Italy, and there was a farm that I visited that was completely self-sufficient. They raised some cows and some goats. They grew these extraordinary vegetables, and they also grew grapes, and they made their own wine. And at the end of every grape row was a rose bush. And the rose bush attracted a whole bunch of things that would normally attack the grapes. So that's sort of a play on that, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The best thing you can do is to learn about your foe. If you're a farmer or really anybody else, just learn about what they like, what they're after, what their behaviors are, and to try to outwit them or distract them, give them something that's more appealing. So yeah, those are good ways to go about it.
Well, I certainly want to talk to you about the Times of India newspaper and their writing of 950 monkey bites in 2018 and your trip to India. But before we go into the specifics, I do have to ask you this. You know, it's all about asking the right questions. And I get a kick out of this. You asked yourself this question: what would it be like to be mugged by a monkey?
Yeah.
You bought a banana. You had a friend of yours recording the whole thing. What happened?
Well, yeah, I was in the north of India, Delhi and Jaipur. A city called Bundi is where this happened. And I'd been reporting on what the media calls the monkey menace. There are a lot of macaques in the urban areas, especially around temples, monkey god temples, Hanuman, where people make offering, give food as a sort of offering to the monkeys. The monkeys are sort of a proxy for the Hanuman god. So the monkeys, they're attracted by all the food that they're given, and they get quite aggressive. And they do things like they will grab a cell phone out of someone's hand and then ransom it. The person will offer a piece of fruit, say, and the monkey will take the fruit and give back the cell phone. So they're pretty slick. So I thought, you know, there were a lot of monkeys up around this fort in the hills. It's an old fort that tourists sometimes hike up to. So I thought, well, I'm just going to hike up there with a bag of bananas in my hand, not holding them out, just holding a plastic market bag and see what happens. And I'm walking along and I see this little head pops up from behind a rock, like the bandits waiting for the stagecoach. And I thought, okay, here it is. And he steps into the path in front of me. We sort of stand there eyeing each other. And then from out of nowhere, from behind me, another one comes in and grabs the bag and takes off. So it was like a purse snatching. And yeah. I don't know if they were working as a team. They didn't appear to share the bananas after that happened. But they were pretty effective.
They must have hung out in Paris and watched some of those snatchers at work, the way they work as, you know, in teams and,
yes,
you know, and all of that, because they're, well, anyway, they're very efficient.
Yeah, one of them distracts you and the other one grabs it. It's a classic technique that they've perfected.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Mary Roach. She has written Fuzz, and it is When Nature Breaks the Law. So why don't we talk a little bit more while we're on the subject of monkeys and India and some of the things, the challenges that they have there and what you experienced while you were there.
Sure. Well, I spent some time at the Wildlife Institute of India, where there are a number of researchers who are trying to come up with a contraception plan that would work for these wild free-ranging monkeys, a lot of them urban monkeys. And that is a challenge for a couple of reasons. Contraceptive as an oral contraceptive, that's tough. You'd have to put it into a bait. So the bait needs to be appealing to the monkeys, but you don't want other species to be eating it. So it's got to be specific to the monkeys. How do you know, how do you tell how much each individual is getting, how often they're taking the bait? So the dosing is an issue. So that's pretty tough, the oral contraceptive. You can do it what's called an immunovaccine. So you would give the animal a vaccine such that it's going to interfere with conception. Or with hormones, or basically going into early menopause. But the problem with, although these work fairly well, these injections, these vaccines, like most vaccines, you need a booster. So that means with a free-ranging population of animals, you know, you'd have to, how do you round up the animal for the second shot? It's something that works fairly well on, say, an island, like the wild horses of Assateague. They've used that there where you can corral the whole population and do the boosters all at once. And you'd have to, of course, mark the animal somehow. With the monkeys, some kind of tattoo you'd need to do, so you'd know, okay, this monkey has had the first shot, needs the booster, this one hasn't. So it's a tremendous amount of work and kind of impossible because they're going where they want to go. And they're so you need a one-shot deal. And that is something National Wildlife Research Center is working on, something that would be one and done, one shot. So that's hopeful, you know, that'd be great. But as the guy in India pointed out, he said, these monkeys are still going to live their lifespan. They live 15 years or so in an urban area. So for that whole time, the population is going to not see much of a difference. You know, they're not going to, it's not going to be very dramatic. And they're going to say, you spent all this money and the problem is still here. So it's a tough scenario. You know, better to try to prevent the monkeys in the first place by not having sources of food, but that's just so hard in a place like New Delhi. There's just too many people, too much trash, and too many people offering them food. So it's
well, you talk about these pathways that humans are taking to go to one meeting or another, and the pathways are shared with the monkeys. And I don't know if these are going to meetings or not, but it's a difficult situation because they're all there together. And this whole vaccine thing is, it's kinder and gentler, because if you think about rat poison that causes the rat to bleed out, I mean, that's a horrible way to go. What this does is, I believe, it turns off the follicles in the reproductive system of order. And it, as you said, it would take 15 years for the younger monkeys to, you know, to pass away. So, but it's kinder and gentler, that's for sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work going on in that area, and I'm hopeful that they'll, you know, come up with something that works. There's some people are doing some work in the UK with oral baits for gray squirrels, which have been limiting the population of red squirrels, sort of muscling out their beloved native red squirrels. The Yankee squirrels have come in and taken over. So they've been surmounting those problems somehow. The getting, you know, seems to be that they're the ones in the, where they put the bait out, the squirrels in that area are taking the right amount somehow. It's it must be hard to do, but they seem to be having some luck with the the formulation that they have. So maybe that will work.
Yeah. And in the chapter where you're talking about the monkeys in India, I recall in the beginning of the chapter, you're talking about a sensationalist reporting of a 72-year-old being stoned by some monkeys, stoned to death. And then later in there, as you investigate and find out what's going on, you determine that the monkeys didn't really stone the 72-year-old. The 72-year-old was sleeping next to some bricks, and some monkeys jumped on the bricks, which toppled them, which then, of course, killed this person. But the monkeys weren't actually stoning a person, were they?
No, it appears that was a bit of an exaggeration. Yeah, the headline writers go a little crazy with some of the tabloids in India. There was one that was described macaques marching in armies across the city of Agra. You picture them with rifles slung over their shoulders and helmets. But I mean, can be aggressive. I mean, for the most part, they're just sort of moving around looking for food and grabbing what they can. But there were a number of cases of kind of a weird string of people falling from balconies and to their deaths, because groups of macaques had come from the roof, jumped down onto the balcony where somebody was sitting And then the person either was startled and lost their balance or tried to scare them off. They're trying to get in through a window or a door, balcony door. And the person lost their balance and fell, including the deputy mayor of New Delhi.
Right.
Died that way. So I don't believe that the monkeys pushed anybody off the balcony, but you know, there in the ensuing scuffle, that people have fallen off and died. There was one very famous case of a macaque that snatched an infant from a mother's breast while it was feeding and then died of injuries. So you can imagine that was huge headlines.
Of course.
So they do cause a lot of problems. It's a very vexing problem for the officials there in New Delhi who have been tasked with fixing the problem.
Yeah, and the thing that fascinates me is, and this is going on all over the world between the ranchers and the conservationists, there's always been that tug and they have to work together. And Utah, of course, is no exception where we are. And it used to be that people would say, you know, there's only so much land as they work out between the ranchers and the coyotes and everything else. But now they're also saying there's only so much water. And it's a real problem out here. You live in California, I'm here in Utah. We know how difficult this is. What are your thoughts on that?
I just wish we could get desalination up and running.
Yeah.
Don't they have that in Israel? Haven't they figured out?
Yeah.
It just seems like that's where we're going to have to head. I mean, in California here, I think we all have our heads in the sand, and there's a lot more sand than there used to be. This is the third year in a row we've had pretty significant drought. It keeps getting worse. Even when we have rain, it's still not enough to bring us back to the levels that will keep us safe from the next year being in drought. And it's worse than ever right now. So, and you're seeing, you know, as a consequence of that, animals coming out of in search of water, animals that would not have strayed into the suburbs or the urban or even urban areas looking for water. So the conflict calls are coming earlier than they used to. You used to be toward the end of the summer when things really got hot and dry. And now the calls, people at Fish and Wildlife get calls, you know, in May, starting in May. So, and climate change affects, you know, with the length of hibernation as well. This isn't water related, but it's climate related. As the temperature rises, with every 2 degrees hot, warmer Fahrenheit, that is, hibernation is about a week shorter. So that's more, you know, more time that the bears are out on the land looking for food and being in proximity to humans. And so that's going to increase the number of conflicts as well.
I like the idea of the desalination plants. I'm from Boston in the Northeast area. I also lived in Maryland for a while, so I know Assateague off the coast of the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Beautiful, beautiful area. But we have a lot of water out there. And maybe if we move away from fossil fuels, we can repurpose some of these oil pipelines to transfer water to some of these Western states. Because the Colorado, I mean, that's having a hard time keeping up.
Oh yeah, the reservoirs out here are so low. And I don't know anything about desalination. How first of all, how hard it is, and second of all,
expensive,
and what the environmental effects. I don't know. Can you just treat the ocean like a tap? I don't know. I don't know about it.
We haven't treated the oceans very well. We might as well.
Might as well just turn them into a faucet.
You know, we had a forensic geologist on our program 4 or 5 years ago, and she went back to the fossil record. And I don't know how far she went back. Like, it was like, as I recall, it was 10,000 or 20,000 years or something. And she, what she basically came up with was that in the last 200-300 years has been a wet time for the West. And typically in the West, it's drought conditions. So we've based our cities on the building of our cities based on water that we've been receiving recently in the last couple hundred years. So we may have made this. This could get interesting.
Yeah, we've assumed that an anomaly is the baseline, and we're really screwed, John.
Mary, I'm with you. Now, along with being screwed, let's have a little levity. I saw a video of you in high heels on a Zamboni ice machine. What were you doing?
Oh, that's a bucket list moment right there.
I'm so jealous.
I was doing some kind of convocation talk up at a school that's way up on the border in the Northeast on the border with Canada, Clarkson, I think it is, Clarkson University. And it was being held in the, of course, hockey is king there, of course. I'm from the Northeast, I know that. So it was being held in the skating rink, the hockey rink. And yeah. I mentioned at the beginning of when I arrived, I said, God, I've always wanted to drive a Zamboni. That's just, you know, a dream of mine to drive the Zamboni. So little known to me, unbeknownst to me, while I was doing my talk, they were calling around and getting permission for me to drive the Zamboni. So when my talk was over, they pulled the Zamboni out and I got to drive it around and off the ice through a fairly narrow, you know, not a lot of wiggle room on either side. I think there were some people who were quite nervous that I'd been allowed to do this.
I think you had like a foot on each side.
But it was a thrill. It was just, I mean, you know, a Zamboni, it's kind of like as difficult as driving a golf cart. You know, it's not it's not a fast vehicle. So, it didn't take a lot of skill, but it was pretty exciting.
And the fedora. So
the fedora, yeah. Somebody put a fedora on my head. That was not actually my hat.
So before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, what domesticated non-humans that live in our home should we be concerned about, specifically houseplants?
Oh, houseplants. Yeah, I have a chapter that deals with plants that kill. Well, particularly in the course of reporting this chapter, I wrote to this plant person at UC Davis, Ann Filmer, and I said, so, you know, poisons, you know, what is it about beans? I was saying specifically like castor beans and the rosary peak are very contain very highly toxic substances. And she said, it's not just beans. And she sent me this list of common garden plants that are in the category of major toxicity. That is, they will kill you. And I looked at the list, there's 100 and something plants there. And 11 of them were either in my yard or had recently been in our yard. So that was surprising, shall we say.
Mary Roach has written a really cool book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. It's just been released. Take a peek. It's a good book. Mary, thanks so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, you bet, John. It was my pleasure.
Always great to hear from Mary Roach and her book, Fuzz. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.